You're listening to The Fifth Estate. This week, Sally Warhaft speaks with a legend of Australian political journalism on the release of his memoir. Here she is in conversation with Kerry O'Brien.
Kerry, of course, is known to all of you, probably mainly, certainly for my generation, with his work on Late Line and the 7:30 Report. But, of course, he's worked for every news organisation pretty much in this country across a career of 50 years and in print, in television, as a foreign correspondent, as a writer, as a documentary feature maker as well. And the breadth of his experience and his insight is now all wrapped up in this 850-page thriller with the stunning title, Kerry O'Brien. And you can buy it after this gig from Readings, and for the reduced price, a special just for us tonight of $40, and Kerry will throw in a free autograph and perhaps a free vignette as well. It's a wonderful book, and it's a real honour for the Wheeler Centre to have you here
Thank you, Sally.
About it. So a big welcome.
Thank you.
And you never know where to start, Kerry, with a life and a working life like yours, so I'm just going to go in alphabetical order and start with ABC. Did you watch Four Corners last night?
I'm not going to tell you what time I watched it, but I did watch it, yes. I watched it on iView.
And how did you feel watching it?
Well, to be absolutely honest, when I heard that they were doing it, I wondered about the wisdom of it. And if it had not been for the fact that both Michelle Guthrie and Milne had agreed to do it, it wouldn't have happened. That's fundamental. And, of course, my immediate question is, why on earth did they? That's fine for Four Corners because it became a very interesting, quite compelling program. But I was shaking my head through a lot of it, and I'm not quite sure what either of them gained from it.
You started at the ABC in 1972, 46 years ago.
That's right.
And remarkable timing because I think of that Gough Whitlam Bankstown address written by Graham Freudenberg.
Blacktown.
Thank you. That was a huge speech in Australia, not just because of how memorable it was, but it was probably the first political speech ever written specifically for television.
There was a sad corollary to that because I was working for Gough when he made his final speech as Labor leader in 1977 at the Opera House, and it was the antithesis of 72 because the party organisers did their level best to write him out of his own launch. And looking back on it, I felt quite sad as I reflected on that. He deserved better than that.
When you look back at the ABC at that time in 1972, you really wanted to be working there. What was it like then?
Well, certainly I started there on a program called This Day Tonight, which was an absolute pioneering program for its time, and it had started late in 67 from memory, but I didn't join them until early 72. But even then, we were still kind of writing the rules as we went along, and I don't mean that in a kind of, a completely anarchistic way, although it had its moments. But it was simply that there had not been a program like it before, and so the ground rules kind of enveloped or developed around it as we went along. So this was probably a really exciting moment. Not just for the ABC itself, it was certainly exciting in ways that they hadn't anticipated for people like Talbot Duckmant and the general manager and some of his offsiders. But it was a wild ride for us. And we were innovating, as I say, as we went. I mean, I had done a very short cadetship in television in 1966 and into 1967 in a very small television newsroom at Channel 9 in Brisbane. And I'd been there for such a short period of time and was still very raw to television. But when I came back to TDT in 72, I mean, I developed somewhat as a journalist, but suddenly in what we call long-form daily current affairs, longer form, it was requiring a set of skills that I barely had. And what I learnt very quickly was that the smart people to learn from were the cinematographers and the editors. Mm. And that was where most of my learning went on. And I just loved it. You know, I mean, I absolutely loved working with film, telling stories that way, and then gradually developing my skills as an interviewer. Four Corners had been in existence by then maybe 12, 13 years. And it was this kind of venerable older program, but stirring still in its own way. Mm. And what a remarkable history Four Corners has had. And I ended up working for Four Corners one, two, three times over the course of my career. I mean, so exciting to be able to work on serious journalism in what is fundamentally a superficial medium, television, to be able to pursue quality and sometimes achieving quality, to be pursuing excellence, never quite getting there, but sometimes getting close, the sense of camaraderie and collegiality in the place was actually the primary thing for me. Mm. We were collegiate in a wonderful way. And we've got Barry Cassidy and Heather Ewart and Maxine McHugh sitting in the front here, and they all know what I'm talking about. To be able to work alongside colleagues as equals, and you're competing, but you are also respecting. You're not climbing over each other's backs to get ahead of them. We were all very healthily competitive in those TDT days, but we supported each other. In a way, we loved each other. You know, we were a happy band of guys and a few women, who were getting opportunities that it would never have occurred to me I was going to get.
It's just a theme throughout the book that you've had a sort of golden working life. That your struggles with work have mostly seemed to be about having to choose between two great options, or at worst having to perhaps bide your time in the sin bin for going off and working for Gough and not being allowed back in the ABC for a few years and those sorts of things.
Yeah, well.
But as well as that beautiful way you describe, you know, the collegiate friendship and support, but also great mentors, the fact that your father just happened to go to school with a journo who got you your very first gig at
Channel 9.
Channel 9.
I mean, poor old daddy was wringing his hands by that stage. I mean, I was so lost I wasn't even a young adult. I was a very adolescent when I went into the workforce. Hadn't done quite well enough to make it to university, and the theory was that I would go off and work in this public service department that was related to the law, and I would get maths, and then I would go to uni and become a lawyer. And of course that was never on, really. But after several years in the wilderness, during which period I always, even now, I forget whether I was in the first or the second draft for Vietnam. I think it might have actually been the first. And I was half hoping I'd go. I was half hoping I'd be called up so that somebody else could decide for me where my life was going to go next. Later, I developed a different view about Vietnam. And the same journalist who opened up a door for me at Channel 9 doing weekend work where I had a chance to prove myself and then got a cadetship, his name was Harry Summers, and he had been a war correspondent for the Herald, for the Sydney Morning Herald, in New Guinea in the war. So he was no slouch, but he was by this stage an ageing bachelor who clearly had developed a very cautious view of the world, because he said to my father, "Now, Jack, you know, I'm sure he'll succeed as a journalist, but whatever happens, don't let him go to Sydney." And Dad said, "Why?" He said, "Jack, it's a jungle down there." And I went to Sydney a couple of years later, and I was there for about 2 months, and one of my flatmates was shot dead by a gangster. It took me a while to summon the courage to tell my father that, in fact, he was a flatmate. Mm. But go.
I'm just wondering if you can give us a bit of a perspective on what's going on at the ABC at the moment, because you write in the book that on the one hand, you feel that its future can just no longer be taken for granted, particularly after the Federal Council of the Liberal Party recently called for it to be privatised. But then on the other hand, you do take us through all sorts of dramas that happened over the time you were there, whether it was David Hill falling out with the board or the crazy years of Jonathan Shire.
Fortunately, the crazy years with Jonathan Shire were quite short, which was possibly because he was a bit crazy.
But is it different at the moment? Do you sense?
Well, I'm not there, Sally. Mm. I mean, I've got friends still at the ABC, and from what I hear, morale is pretty shot. I'm sure that everyone working at the ABC would love to know what's going on at the ABC. And that's tragic. The ABC is a really fundamentally important institution for this country. 99.9% of the people who work there are utterly committed in whatever job they're in to be the best at their craft that they can be. And the bullshit that has had to be tolerated over so many years, the poison that's been thrown our and their way, is intolerable and inexcusable. And damage is done, damage has been done, damage will continue to be done, unless the ABC can have clear air to do what it is supposed to do. And that is, in terms of journalism, report fearlessly and without favour, and well, and within the spread and the grasp of its remit.
You were offered a cadetship when you were quite young at The Australian, which was made redundant before you even started.
I was sacked.
You were sacked.
I was sacked before I began. They must have known something.
There's a great quote. I'm going to read this from your book. "I've wondered more than once over the years how different my path through journalism might have been had that cadetship come through. To get in on the ground floor of a new national paper, rubbing shoulders with some of the best journalists in the country, all at such an early stage of my career, would have been a great opportunity and could have taken me anywhere." I just wondered where it was you thought you might have gone that you didn't go in the career that you had.
Well, and maybe I would have wound my way back into television at some point, but for a paper like The Australian, and at that stage, it was still a young paper and it was still the only national paper, and to this day it's the only truly daily national paper, the Fin Review is a specialist national paper, although, you know, with the internet, of course, everything's national and international. I would have imagined, all my thoughts as that very young journalist were to get south, to go south, and Sydney was my target. So I would imagine after I'd been in the place in the Brisbane office with the one journalist who was there, after about 3 days I would have started working out how quickly I'd be able to get to Sydney. And so maybe it might have taken me a couple of years. Mm. But I would have been in the Sydney newsroom for a time, cutting my teeth, learning more, finding mentors. And I would probably by then have sharpened my interest in politics, and I would have been probably beginning to agitate for Canberra. At a certain point, the opportunity to be a foreign correspondent might have opened up. So and getting better and better at writing for print, developing that side of the craft. At a certain point, because I'm a fairly restless spirit, I think my mind would have turned back towards television, and I would have been no doubt caught by Four Corners and TDT. So who knows? But I could have gone overseas and never come back. I'd like to think I would have, because I think I've always felt a strong pull. I am Australian. In my heart, in my head, I am Australian. And I suspect that no matter where I would have gone in the world, I would have always wanted to come back. But this business, I've talked a couple of times in the book about it, the sort of crossroads we find ourselves at and the number of times we make choices to go there rather than there or there. And, you know, you can have your quiet little musings about these things, but in the end, when you do make that choice, that's where you're going. And that is then the only path you know. That's the course that then might lead to this and that, and you then meander your way through the rest of your life. Mm.
Well, you landed, of course, for 6 years at Lateline, which you describe as close as you came to perfection in half a century of journalism, just a magic where that depth and quality and focus was so supported. The only sort of equivalent show I can think of now, it is Late Night Live on the radio.
Yeah.
And it's hard to imagine anybody but Philip Adams ever doing that show.
Yeah. That's certainly Philip's view.
Can you... It sure is.
And let's hope he's still there in 10 years.
Oh, look, at least 20, please. I mean, can you imagine that there can ever be a cultural shift now where a program like Late Line could come back? Because, you say, the hunger is just as much there from an audience.
Of course it is. The hunger has always been there. I mean, you know, I was a great fan as a kid of the Western genre, the old cowboys of the West, and there was always a newspaper man in town. Always a newspaper man in town. The curiosity to know and the hunger and the thirst for knowledge has always been there and will always be there, I hope. I see no reason in the world why the ABC couldn't go back and re-embrace a Late Line format tomorrow. Mm. I never bought the decision for a minute. I don't think it's got anything to do with, there is nothing about the various platforms we now exploit with our media coverage. There's nothing about those platforms that mitigates against us having Late Line. I mean, if that was the view, then you wouldn't have Four Corners. What is it that you can't have anything that requires people to be reflective and to be attentive for 27 or the 28 minutes of the half-hour show? It's 45 minutes for Four Corners. Documentaries are still popular. What is it about Late Line that no longer is relevant? Mm-hmm. Frankly, I think that's a rubbish argument. Mm. And that program was unique in this country when it started. They changed the format some time after Maxine took over from me, and then I think for the start of when Tony was doing the job, Tony Jones, they kept the format, and then they went off at a tangent. They made it more of a kind of newsy program. They still had a long interview, but they did not have a single issue for the full half hour. Mm. And at that moment, they lost the essence of a really important program. Mm. I'd love them to go back to it tomorrow, and I'll guarantee you that they will have a strong enough audience to more than justify its existence, and they will be a more credible public broadcaster for it.
I got such a strong... such a strong sense of the care that went into every single episode of that program, and right down to you insisting that the 10:30 start time was made part of your contract, which
absolutely,
so that they couldn't muck around with it, so that the audience.
Well, they did, but they couldn't muck around with it as much as they would have liked.
Beyond about 20 minutes,
we had. You remember a program called The Big Gig with Wendy Harmer? We had endless wrestles with Wendy because, of course, they were live too. And when you're live on air, there's a limit to what the programmers can do to actually take you off the air. Mm. Unfortunately, Wendy understood that as well as I did. Mm. So we had endless tussles with Big Gig. But had I not had that in the contract, we could have been going on anywhere between 10:30 at night. We'd have been starting anywhere between 10:30 at night and 10 to 11, 5 to 11, because the programmes could have felt that they had the licence to fit this program and that program in, and that would have hurt us substantially, because the number of times people said to me, you know, Kerry, last night I just checked in on my way to bed to see what you had on, and half an hour later I realised I was still there. Mm. And that was part of the magic of the show. You know, it was this wonderful capacity to be able to tour the world in search of the great minds. And we did it again and again and again. And the only puzzle for me, and I'm sure for Max, was not quite understanding why some of those great minds were prepared to come on. Because sometimes we were getting them up in the middle of their night or very early in their morning to come on to a relatively small, particularly if they're in America and we're promising them an audience of 400,000 people or something, where, you know, a program like ours in America would have had 5 million. But turn up they did. And that was just a wonderful opportunity for us all, including the audience.
You're, you know, famous, of course, I think, above all, for your political interviews. And there's a fantastic bit of review from the TV critic Tony Squires in the book on the dullness of the 1998 election campaign. And he wrote, "The only person who seems to be vibed by the whole process is the ABC's Gerry O'Brien, who actually isn't human. The glint comes into his eye as politician after politician pops him or herself onto the rotisserie for a 7:30 report basting. The best bit is watching gormless pollies from one side smiling and nodding as their opponents are carved up, then seeing the surprise in their eyes as the pitchfork is turned on them, with the redhead devils advocating his way up their personal corridor of power." I just loved that.
I mean, you might think it's terribly self-indulgent for me to have had that one, but to have put that in the book, but the I did a little bit, but the main reason—it's
a memoir,
Gerry. The main reason it's in there was to make the point about being a devil's advocate.
Well, that's right, and a bias claim was never upheld in your entire time either.
No.
Of all the people that you sparred with, and I found this personally the most fascinating part of the book is when you write about John Howard. And I sort of didn't realise that for 12 of your 15 years at 7:30, John Howard was the Prime Minister, and he was the single most constant presence in your working life.
It says a lot about the success of our program, really.
You said it became a kind of endurance test. It sort of made me think, who would you have, you know, liked to have had if you could have picked someone else?
Oh, I wouldn't. I won't even try and think about that.
You'd be like
trying the fact is it was him.
Yeah.
I mean, we started the National 7:30 report in December 95 and he became Prime Minister in March of 1996 and he was there for 11 and a half years. So even before he became Prime Minister, he was still a constant presence because he was the opposition leader and we went straight into a pre-election period. And so what it was really, it was about 100 interviews with him. I stopped counting after a while, but it would have been about that. And simply because of the nature of our program and the fact that he came on so often, really those interviews included probably all of the milestone moments of his prime ministership. And it was a long prime ministership, so it's covered a lot of political history,
history. You point out that the three biggest moments or events in his time in office were Tampa, September 11, and Port Arthur. It's particularly September 11. In fact, 2001 is the only year you give a chapter to in the book. And
I think I said not a great year.
It was not
a vintage year.
Not a vintage year. I've been wanting somebody to write about this since it happened. The coincidence of John Howard being in Washington when those events happened. That, you know, he was rushed to a bunker, he went to Congress the next day, got a standing ovation, then invoked the ANZUS Treaty. And I always felt that personal experience for him really affected, it had to have affected his response as a Prime Minister. And I asked him once when he wrote his own memoir and he denied it. But I wondered what you thought.
Look, I think I'm not going to be cynical about this, and he deserves more than cynicism, absolutely. Whatever impact those actual events had on him, John Howard, so yes, John Howard, human being, would have absorbed that shock in his own way, as anybody else did who was close to the events. But he was also John Howard, utterly focused politician. And he would have been instantly sizing up, and he was taking advice from his ambassador, Michael Thorley, from that day about the implications of all of this, and was told Afghanistan will be big, but the Americans will turn quickly to Iraq. So on that first day, John Howard no doubt began to think about Iraq and would have been thinking about that as he invoked the ANZUS Treaty. So I think he also saw... he didn't feel a great affinity with Bill Clinton, and Clinton was there for the first part of his prime ministership. I mean, the political gaps would have been felt, but also he would have seen Clinton as relatively close to Keating. Didn't feel a rapport there. Looked for and felt a rapport with George W. Bush, and I think because of that sense of affinity, I think that probably played a big part in his consciousness in taking the paths that he took, particularly into Iraq.
You describe his leadership with Port Arthur and gun control as inspired. But there are other aspects of his prime ministership that I think you would describe as far less inspired, and in fact a real sense of John Howard, the public politician, and really brilliant at that political craft, particularly in times of crisis. But another side of him where... the material that you were getting on the one hand just didn't add up to what was being said on the other. Hmm. What moments of his prime ministership, I suppose, dismayed you the most in that respect?
Well, first of all, he absolutely deserves... He will have his place in history for Port Arthur. And that was real leadership, because he took on a tough issue. He knew that the cities broadly would be backing it. But he still took on a very tough challenge with regard to the other important part of the Conservative constituency, which was the bush. So not only was he handing a poisoned sword to Tim Fischer, who he was asking to come with him, and in fairness to Fischer, Fischer was keen to embrace it as well. But the Nats had big problems over that, and it wasn't just to the bush, but it was also with two states, Western Australia and Queensland. And they got Rob Borbidge on side, but that wasn't easy. So there were some very tough moments for them. You know, there was a protest meeting in Gympie, which was just, you know, throbbing with anger. There was an effigy of Tim Fischer hanging from a beam. So no one will ever take that from John Howard, and we all can be pleased that he took the stance that he did then, because largely those gun controls have held. But having said that, and I haven't spent a great deal of time around the pure economics of his 11 and a half years, he and Costello, what emerged for me from all those interviews, and I didn't just look at transcripts for many of them, I looked at the actual interviews for the first time, really, because I never really looked back at my interviews as I did them. And I also went back in and read his own book around those events. And I also looked at the wider history. I looked what other people, like the Kellys and others, had written about those times. So I looked at the picture that history was forming around the Howard years. I looked at his own rationales and explanations and omissions, and I measured them against what he was saying at the time, and some really interesting patterns emerged for me. And not least of them was the pattern of divisiveness over a number of issues. the waterfront. Nobody would argue, except perhaps a few wharfies from the time, but nobody would argue that there wasn't a significant need or a need for significant waterfront reform. Nobody would argue that that there was a need. Well, there wasn't necessarily a need to respond on WIC, but it did become a big political issue, and it was almost like Mabo in the sense that it required legislation to give a framework to it rather than to have endless court cases trying to work out the WIC judgment on native title. But then there was the Tampa, and then there was Kids Overboard, and then there was Iraq. And in all of those circumstances, there was a divisive impact on Australian society, and it wasn't just the WIC case at all. There was also the Stolen Generation, which occurred right at the height of the WIC debate. There was also John Howard's ongoing obsession with the so-called culture wars, and there was Pauline Hanson. And John Howard's reluctance to meet her head on, as some of his most senior colleagues wanted him to do, including Tim Fisher, including Alexander Downer, Peter Costello, even some of his most senior public servants. Mm. So I hope that there is a fresh picture, in a way, perhaps in a sense. And I'm not setting myself up as a historian. I really am just trying to walk a path through the history of my times and from the perspectives where I can, from the personal experience of it, to shed some extra beam of light on it. I just hope it's done that it's given, maybe it's nuanced for some people, but I'm not big on nuance. Maybe it adds another element to the overall picture.
Oh, I mean, it certainly does. But it is a sort of history of sorts as well. It's almost a sort of kind of ethnographic kind of
a bit Zelig-like.
You say, too, that as well as that divisiveness, that the Labor Party also played their part in that.
Sure did.
And tell us more about their role.
I thought... Kim Beazley was Labor leader for the first two elections after Keating's defeat, 1998-2001. And I can remember interviewing Kim Beazley very early in 2001 and then again within the next several months. Both times he was like the kid in the candy shop. I won't make any cheap jokes around that. But he was like the kid in the candy shop. And he would say, "Don't have to do a thing. I don't have to do a thing. Howard is going to do it all for us." This was the GST term. This was the term in which they introduced the GST. In 2001, there was certainly some turmoil around it and there was some heat about it. And for Kim Beazley, I was not any kind of close confidant in any way, shape or form of Kim Beazley's. I knew him somewhat. And I'm thinking, well, if you're saying this to me, you're saying it to everyone. But that was his perspective. He didn't have to do anything. And Howard, at a certain point, this occurred to John Howard as well, and he thought, "Thank you very much, Kim." And he set to work, and he became more and more focused as the year progressed. And even before Tampa, he was beginning to turn the tide, and he was beginning to get Beazley's measure, and he was starting to throw in those lines about Beazley's ticker. Which then began to stick. Mm. And the by-election here in Aston. Yes, Aston, where the Liberals were certainly expected to lose and didn't. They hung on to it. And yes, there was a local issue about freeways that was a part of it, but fundamentally Kim Beazley should have won that election and should have taken that as a big alarm bell going off. But then came Tampa, then came September 11, and immediately after September 11, then came Kids Overboard. And let me just say about Kids Overboard, I've been fortunate to be able to call on some fantastic investigative work with some of these issues, like Ann Davies and, Helen Trinker, yep. Ann Davies and Helen Trinker on the waterfront. Terrific book. very revealing book on the waterfront and the dogs and the balaclavas and all the rest of it, and how closely Patrick's, the stevedores, were working with the government to sack a workforce. But then on Tampa and Kids Overboard, David Marr and Marion Wilkinson with Dark Victory. So again, I'm able to draw on these sources as well as my own and other things, Senate committees and so on. So there's a Senate committee. Fran Kelly was our Canberra correspondent at the time. Here in my transcripts, Fran is reporting the results of the Senate majority report, which recorded that on 14 occasions in the month that the Kids Overboard story ran strongly, all those damaging headlines initially, then turning to doubt, then turning to scepticism, and a clamour for the truth to come out. And 14 times, according to that Senate Select Committee, Reith and his senior advisers were told no kids were thrown overboard. No kids thrown overboard. And yet we are to believe that at no point did it occur to this senior minister, this senior cabinet minister in the Howard government, that perhaps he should tell the Prime Minister. Mm-hmm. And Howard, I should have earmarked it for tonight, really. Howard's response is almost like a... It's almost like a kind of hear no evil, see... There's an echo of hear no evil, see no evil. He actually says in one interview, well, Kerry, if nobody told me and I didn't hear anything about this, then how can I be held responsible? And so I've looked at the Howard style in the way he would respond to questions if he didn't particularly... On Hanson, I would say to him something like, well, do you agree with Pauline Hanson? And he would say, well, I certainly agree with her right to say these things. And again, Marion and David take a microscope to the Howard language.
Was Howard the first to sort of start sort of suffocating the great political interview in terms of a really honest exchange between the interviewer and the interviewee? He chewed up all that time always with long answers, and he, you know, he was very deft.
I did my best to respond with long questions, Sally, but that didn't always work. And Heather, I do recognise your laugh. In a way, yes. I mean, Bob Hawke was entirely capable of an extremely long answer. I mean, I did a Four Corners interview with him once on a 10th anniversary documentary on the dismissal, and we chewed up about 50 minutes of interview with Bob Hawke, and we ran five. So Howard wasn't on his own. But in terms of politicians engaging in the spirit of an interview, where of course they do want to come out on top, of course they still want to get their points across, and yes, they don't want to find themselves with their backs to the wall. But by and large, more often than not, the politicians of those eras leading up to, I mean, I'm talking really, I suppose really from, in my experience, from Gough through to much later, I think the point where the game of using the interview as a platform, manipulating the interview as much as possible to your own ends, not entering the spirit of the interview as an exchange for the benefit of an audience, and actually being seen at some point in your answer to genuinely answer the question, I think probably that the Howard era was the beginning of the end of that.
2009.
I do try and go into some of the ways he did that.
And
I even interested myself.
Yeah. you pick out 2009 obviously as another pivotal year, and a year of accidents, with sort of Tony Abbott accidentally taking the leadership from Joe Hockey, Malcolm Turnbull, of course, in that contest, and the sort of some would say, devastating moment when Barack Obama postponed his trip to Australia because of some banking regulation issue here.
Might have been health.
Whatever it was, I suspect if he'd known the consequences of that delay, he may have actually reconsidered it for the sake of all Australians. Yeah. He was a pretty worldly guy. Because you say, and I totally agree, that if that hadn't happened, the Labor Party could never have rolled Kevin Rudd.
I don't think so, because that was the last sitting of Parliament. That was the last week of that session of Parliament. And I can't conceive of even some of the people who were directly engaged in orchestrating that sacking of Rudd. I don't think even they would have been able to compel their colleagues to call a challenge to a prime minister in a week that the American president is visiting your country. It wouldn't have happened. And not happening then could well have... it certainly would have given... It would have made it much harder for a challenge to occur out of session. It would have given Rudd respite. He would have had the option of calling an election, if he saw one coming and was desperate enough and with his survival instinct strong enough, he could have actually held them off to go for an election. And again... even if he had gone for an election in whenever they went, was it September, August, September? Yeah, no, I think 99% chance he would have gone to the election as Prime Minister, and whether he would have then been forced to surrender it to Gillard sometime in that next term or not, that's, you know, who knows. Had he not learnt the error of some of his ways, then he probably almost certainly would have gone. But it would have been a different dynamic for Labor.
Now, of course, either side would execute a prime minister probably in the middle of a state dinner with a visiting president.
Except that Kevin Rudd inadvertently, I mean, cynics would say he did it for him, or he did it as a kind of... Let's put the best context on Kevin Rudd's demand that they change the system of voting for leader and brought the rank and file in for, I think, 50-50 of it, gave the rank and file a genuine say in the future leader. The bottom line is they've now had the same leader for 5 years. And in that time, that leadership, I mean, yes, there are question marks about the public's embrace of Bill Shorten, but to give him credit, he has presided over a pretty united team that seems to have as its primary focus actual policy. And I think they're deriving a benefit from that, while at the same time, on the other side of the fence, there is the kind of mayhem going on that that Labor did so well between in 2010 and the couple of years after, yeah.
You write about, that there is a threat to Western liberal democracies. We had Bob Carr here a couple of weeks ago. Honestly, it was so depressing, the conversation around the US midterms and his thoughts more generally about the state of the world. Stephen Smith has been a recent guest here at the Fifth Estate. I mean, bleak, just so bleak, their outlook. I wonder how bleak you are, Kerry.
Well, I'm not naturally bleak. So.
No, I know. I don't think Bob is either. I'm not sure about Stephen Smith, but.
Well, I mean, the key lies in my children's generation. That's the key, and that's the hope. But if you're looking at the state of democracy in Australia now, it's not great. We have a media. Where you've essentially got the ABC and SBS, you've got the public broadcasters, you've got the Fairfax Media, you've got and you've got this great large lump of ownership with Murdoch, and then you've got other disparate elements. But for one proprietor, no matter who it is, to have 70% of the print output of the country, and it's probably more than that now for all I know. I mean, he keeps buying up. He's bought up bought into a lot of lot more regional and rural papers. Through Lachlan, they've got two commercial radio networks. He's got Sky, and they've had an interest in Ten. It's too much. It is not democratic. It is anti-democratic. It is anti-democratic, and he has a capacity to shut down debate at times. And it's not just what he might do or not do. It's about how fearful politicians become. And it's another form of self-censorship. They start to second-guess what Rupert might or might not be okay with. And we all saw what Malcolm Turnbull said about Rupert in relation to losing his leadership. So that's not good. The two major parties, the two-party system, which has fundamentally underpinned Australian politics for so much of its history since Federation, is at risk. And the smart heads within those two major parties surely must know that. I mean, the Liberal Party has lost its way. It is nothing like the party it once was in terms of its ideological leanings. It has tilted to the right, and you've got this kind of grassroots movement, almost like a Tea Party movement in a way, within the Liberal Party, which is skewing it to the right. So that somebody like a Malcolm Turnbull, despite the fact that the country was screaming for him to take over from Tony Abbott, and if he'd waited even another month, there would have been more people inside the Liberal Party screaming for him to take over too. I cannot believe that he genuinely really needed to put himself so much into the thrall of the far right of his party to become Prime Minister. And he promised so much with that great opening stanza, and then to deliver so little. And for him now to be claiming some of the things he's claiming as triumph, sorry, Malcolm. Sorry, Malcolm. You had your chance and you failed. And you look at Scott Morrison now and you think, well, sorry, Scott. And then you look at the other side and, yes, you see a stability. We're going to have to wait to take our true measure of Bill Shorten when he becomes Prime Minister next year, if that happens. Because as an opposition leader, he may be holding his party together and he may be running a united ticket, if you like, and then that is a tick for his leadership capacity. But if you're looking to Bill Shorten for inspiration, you're not seeing it. You are not seeing it. And it's not, you know, the for all the fact that the opinion polls are not the whole story, they're only a part of the story, and only if you take them in large measure, not bit by bit. And you can win government without being a popular leader. Yes, 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 all of that's true. But it is reflective of what we all know in what we see in Bill Shorten. He does not inspire. There's not a sense of Bill Shorten being a man of vision. And he may be a man of vision, but it does not come through that he's a man of vision. He does not come through as a man who is offering hope. He is not coming through as a man who is offering to take us through a rejuvenation process of the two-party system. So you see younger people year after year, and this is the cumulative effect, possibly going all the way back to the dismissal in 1975, but there is a cumulative effect of disappointment in the broad Australian sweep of democracy about the state of democracy, and it is reflected in the Lowy Centre's surveys year after year of young Australians, where young Australians are at best ambivalent about the value of democracy. How sad is that? And we see the path that America's going down. We see what's happening in Hungary, in Poland, in Sweden, in Britain with Brexit. We see all these signs. Italy, where the Interior Minister openly speculates about how he could possibly move all the gypsies out of Italy and expresses regret that a number of them are citizens and therefore he can't send them. This is a continent that saw 500,000 gypsies wiped out in their own genocide in the Hitler era. These are seriously worrying times. Seriously worrying times. And we want leaders. We want leaders who can lead us back from the road that we are all, one way or another, walking down. We absolutely cannot make any assumptions about the future of democracy in this country. We just can't. History changes. Nothing's a given, particularly in this age. I mean, just imagine. Look at how we've reacted to the relatively minor problem of refugees. Yes, it's a problem. Yes, there's a strong argument that says any nation has to have an integrity about their borders. But don't tell me that having arrived at the Pacific solution, that's all we have to do. That having, let's say, okay, you stop the boats. Are you happy to just stay there? Are you happy to watch these people and their children fester on Nauru? Is that what you want to be in the eyes of the? Is that what you want us to be in the eyes of the world? No government should be content to sit and play politics with that. Absolutely not. And then you take climate change. Cast forward 10, 15, 20 years and sea levels rise and countries and Pacific states are wiped out and low-lying countries when the big storm surges and some of the more violent storm surges and periods of storm surges take place and the possibility of a much greater movement of people, of displaced people takes place. How are we going to deal with that? And then you look at the future of work in the digital age, and we are all in the eye of the digital storm. Where is the national debate taking place about the future of work and the changing nature of work, which is changing in front of our eyes? There are skill shortages in this country now across a whole range of areas. We are not training sufficient people in the skills that are required today, let alone the skills that are required tomorrow. And what we are feeling now in terms of the pace of change is nothing compared to the pace of change that are 10 years down the track and 20 years down the track. We don't know what's coming. We just know something is. We don't really know the shape of our future. We just don't know. But it could well be that we are looking at a future where there will be a number, and it might be a large minority or it might be a small majority of people who will be in full-time work, and many of them might be overworked. And there will be many, many more who will be seriously underworked and many more that might have no work. We don't know, but that is a very strong possibility. We've got to start thinking now about how we control that evolution into the new world of work. And how we minimise its impact, not only minimise the impact, but actually make it work for us. I mean, Stephen Hawking has warned us about this, about our incapacity to match pace with the development and the revolution of digital technology. Where is that national debate and where is that leadership? And there are other issues that I've identified towards the end of the book about the big challenges. And you ask that against the deficit of good, strong, inspired leadership, courageous leadership. And you've got to wonder.
You do.
Sorry, more. I got a bit worked up.
No,
there.
That was bleak, though, wasn't it? One really...
I'm much more controlled in the book.
There's one more. He is, actually. It is. But no, that passion is there too in the writing. A really quick one from me because he likes long answers and we'll have time for a couple of questions, but I really do want to ask this about writing a memoir because it's a kind of gift, it's something you offer, but not that many people get to write one, or certainly they shouldn't.
I'm glad you added that.
I wonder what you learned about yourself.
That I'm real. That my journalism has been real. That the people who've come along on that road with me are real. That my life has been worth living for me. And that I hope I've given something. Mm. So it's reminded me again and again about the importance of journalism, of good, pure, strong journalism, how fundamental it is to a healthy society. And I'm reassured by that. And even though the media industry finds itself in pretty ordinary shape in many ways now, you just see some wonderful younger journalists coming through, but many of them without mentors, without the kinds of mentors that I was able to, I was going to say suck dry, but that's not a very attractive image.
Cadetships, none of those tools of the trade.
And this is true, you know, there are so many industries that have walked away from their responsibilities, their training responsibilities and apprenticeships and cadetships and so on. Some of them are coming back. But despite the fact that we are in a state of serious confusion in our own industry, I have no doubt that we will find our feet again as a craft, as a vital craft, and that strong journalism will re-emerge. I must say, even if you don't read the book, if you haven't heard of an Irish journalist named Fintan O'Toole, who writes for the Irish Times, go and Google Fintan O'Toole and a couple of columns that he has written this year about fascism and pre-fascism. And I've had nothing more with the rest of my life than to roam around the suburbs and towns of Australia distributing copies of this thing. I would feel that the rest of my life was well lived. He is, it's all there in his writing, and he talks about pre-fascist America, and he ain't kidding.
It's a great answer, Kerry, and you are real, and I'm going to give away one thing in the book, but it is in the first page, that the dimple is real too.
So is the hair.
We've got time for like one or two really quick questions, and I'm sorry that it's been cut a bit short for questions.
Kerry, could you name me one man or one woman you would consider is or could become a statesman?
Ooh. Look, I'll squib that in a sense. No, not immediately. But I tell you what, when you look at the groundswell in America from young Americans after the Florida shootings, and that wonderful young woman in particular with the close-cropped hair, you know, that kind of inspiration stays with you. Now, she isn't just going to go back into the woodwork. The Me Too movement is a different kettle of fish. I'm primarily, you know, I think you understand that and you tick that too. Although at the same time, sometimes I'm left slightly uneasy at our great capacity to witch hunt. And I don't mean that predominantly in relation to Me Too, but the Black Lives Matter movement as well. You know, you're seeing these groundswells happening, and you're seeing people take stands individually and collectively, and that is a good sign. Don't give up on human capacity. I mean, human nature today is what human nature... I can't speak for the troglodyte age, although there are still a few of them around. But really, the human spirit is what it has always been. And the human spirit, you know, Hitler died in his bunker and the human spirit emerged. So no matter how grim things get, that is a constant. Our capacity for good at least matches our capacity for evil.
Thank you. I'm not suggesting that becoming a republic could be the answer to everything, but could it actually give us a bit of a fillip about democracy?
My chapter on the republic is very short.
And it's mostly sort of kicking Turnbull in the shins, really, isn't it?
That was really only on the last two pages. But really it's a wonderful illustration of everything that went wrong for Malcolm afterwards. He displayed very little political nous then, and you've got to say he's been consistent in that, largely. But the bottom line is that I don't believe there will be a republic, certainly in my lifetime, unless those people arguing for a republic can come up with a process that involves a direct election. I know that there is a large body in the political culture that finds that prospect anathema, and I understand all the reasons for that. I think there has to be a way found to allow for a direct election that curbs, that limits the power of a directly elected president so that that president can't then run amok and abuse the power. How you codify the powers, how you walk down this road, the bottom line is a country like Ireland can do it, we can. But whether I personally think that's the best idea or not, I am utterly convinced that that a country that today is as cynical as it is about mainstream politicians and more politicians than deserve that cynicism, then there is no way they're going to embrace a republic where the president is selected by, no matter what caveats apply, by a parliament. And the Republican, and while you've got that kind of mood there, and then you've got nice Harry and nice William and so on, it doesn't help.
One more super quick, because I'm feeling like Wendy Harmer in The Big Gig now.
I'm coming after you, Sally, and I'm saying it's all right.
Okay, thank God. Last one.
Well, since you needed another question, you mentioned Stephen Hawking. And one of the things, I guess what you were talking about, was the fact that he's saying, look out, because robots are going to become emotionally able to make decisions and whatnot, and we're not really embracing that. We're not really understanding the capacity of what a robot will be able to do.
Okay, I'm going to have to let you respond, Gary.
Okay, look, that is what Hawking's saying, and I borrowed it a little bit because what I'm saying is it's not just that. I mean, if his worst fears came true, that would not be great. Nor will it be great if the technology continues to develop at the extraordinarily rapid rate it is now, in fact even exponentially greater, and we struggle along in the wake with indifferent leadership, with indifferent knowledge, with limited knowledge about where we're going and what the implications of it are, we are going to be a riven society, not just here, but globally. And maybe some countries will come to terms with it more than others, but what he's talking about is a part of the mosaic that I'm talking about. It's about our capacity to actually stay in control of the whole revolution so that we can actually make it work for us rather than us work for it. And I think sometimes we are so excited about this breakthrough or that breakthrough, and if you happen to be a business leader, about quote-unquote productivity, replacing people with machines, and we don't even know how that's going to work out either, then, you know, I mean, it's hugely problematic.
Mm. Kerry, it's just been so delightful. Just a reminder that you can get a copy of the book. It's called Kerry O'Brien, in case you forgot.
That wasn't my idea. That was the publisher's.
And, I mean, there's so much I haven't even touched on tonight. There are beautiful passages where Kerry talks about his family life, particularly wonderful talking about Ireland, father of six children, father of twins, go Kerry. it really is, it's a really well thought out, really beautiful book, and I congratulate you and thank you so much for coming to talk about it with us here at the Wheeler Centre.
Thank you very much for your generosity, Sally. Thank you.
Kerry O'Brien. Thank you.
Kerry O'Brien in conversation with Sally Warhaft for the Fifth Estate. This event was recorded live at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne on Tuesday, November 13th, 2018. The end of the year is approaching and our next episode will be our last until 2019. Listen in a couple of weeks for our annual political wrap with guests Gabrielle Chan and George Megalogenis. If you like the Fifth Estate, share us with your friends. We're in your favourite podcast apps, or you can listen online at wheelercentre.com. You'll find a lot more there too. Until next time, take care.